Rock.com.
Hello and welcome to Aryan Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and today is the 14th narration from Geoffrey of Monmouth's The History of the Kings of Britain. And today we're going to hear about the monster of Mont-Saint-Michel. As soon as the contents of this reply were made known, Lucius Hiberius was ordered by the Senate to send a proclamation to the kings of the Orient to instruct them to prepare an army and to set out in his company to conquer Britain. As quickly as possible, they duly assembled. Epistrophus, the king of the Greeks, Mustensar, the king of the Africans, Ali Fatima, the king of Spain, Hyrtacius, the king of the Parthians, Bocchus of the Medes, Sertorius of Libya, Xerxes, king of the Iturii, Pandrasus, king of Egypt, Micipsa, king of Babylon, Polytetes, duke of Bithynia, Teucer, duke of Phrygia, Evander of Syria, Echion of Boeotia, Hippolytus of Crete, and all the leaders and princes who owed them homage. From among the members of the Senate, there came Marius Lepidus, Gaius Metellus Cocta, Quintus Milvius Catulus, Quintus Carucius, and enough more to bring the total up to 400,160 when they were all counted. They made all the preparations which they considered necessary, and then set out for Britain towards the beginning of August. When Arthur learned of their coming, he handed over the task of defending Britain to his nephew Mordred, and to his queen, Guinevere. He himself set off with his army for Southampton, and embarked there with the following wind. Round about midnight, as he sailed briskly on through the deep sea, surrounded by ships too numerous to count, and following his course closely with joy in his heart, Arthur fell into a very deep slumber. As he lay lulled in sleep, he saw a bear flying through the air. At the growling of the bear, every shore quaked. Arthur also saw a terrifying dragon flying in from the west and lighting up the countryside with the glare of its eyes. When these two met, they began a remarkable fight. The dragon, which I have described, attacked the bear time and time again, burning it with its fiery breath, and finally hurling its scorched body down to the ground. Arthur woke up at this point and described what he had dreamed to those who were standing around. They interpreted it for him, telling him that the dragon was himself and the bear some giant or other with which he was to fight. The battle between the two animals meant the struggle which would take place between him and the giant, and the victory of the dragon was that which Arthur himself would win. Arthur, however, was sure that it all meant something different, for he considered that this dream had come about because of himself and the emperor. Once the night had passed and the dawn began to glow red in the sky, they landed in the port of Barfleur. There they quickly pitched their tents and prepared to await the coming of the kings of the islands and the leaders of the neighbouring provinces. Meanwhile, the news was brought to Arthur that a giant of monstrous size had emerged from certain regions in Spain. This giant had snatched Helena, the niece of Duke Hoel, from the hands of her guardians and had fled with her to the top of what is now called Mont-Saint-Michel. The knights of that district had pursued the giant, but they had been able to do nothing against him. It made no difference whether they attacked him by sea or by land, for he either sank their ships with huge rocks or else killed them with a variety of weapons. Those whom he captured, and there were quite a few, he ate while they were still half alive. The next night, at 2 o'clock, Arthur came out from the tents without telling his companions, roused his seneschal Kay and his cupbearer Bedivere, and set out for the mount. Being a man of such outstanding courage, he had no need to lead a whole army against monsters of this sort. Not only was he himself strong enough to destroy them, but by doing so he wanted to inspire his men. When they came near to the mount, they saw a fire gleaming on the top, and a second fire ablaze on a smaller peak. Bedivere the cupbearer was ordered by the king to make his way to this second fire by boat. He could not have reached it in any other way, for the hill rose straight up from the sea. As Bedivere began to climb up to the summit, he heard a woman's scream come from above him. This terrified him at first, for he was afraid that the monster was there. His courage soon returned, however, and he drew his sword from its scabbard and climbed up the hillside. On the top, he could see nothing at all, except the great fire which he had observed before. Then he made out a newly made tumulus nearby, and at its side an old woman who was weeping and wailing. The moment she saw him, the old woman stopped weeping and began to speak to him instead. "Unhappy man," said she, "what ill fortune has brought you to this spot? I pity you, for you are about to suffer death by the most unspeakable tortures. This very night a foul monster will destroy the flower of your youth. The most odious of all giants will come here, cursed be his name. It is he who carried the duke's niece off to this mountain. I have just buried her in this very spot. With her he brought me, her nurse. Without a moment's hesitation, he will destroy you too, by some unheard-of form of death. How hideous the fate of my fairest nursling was. When this foul being took her in his arms, fear flooded her tender breast, and so she ended a life which was worthy of a longer span." Since he was unable to befoul with his filthy lust this child who was my sister's soul, my second self, the joy and happiness of my life, in the madness of his bestial desire he raped me against my will, as I swear by God and my own old age. Flee, my dear sir, flee. If he comes, as he usually does, to have intercourse with me, he will find you here and tear you to pieces, and destroy you miserably. Bedivere was as much moved as it was possible for a human being to be. He soothed the old woman with kind words, comforted her with the promise of speedy help, and returned to Arthur to tell him all that he had discovered. Arthur grieved for the fate of the girl, and ordered the other two to leave him to attack the monster alone. Should the need arise, they were to come to his assistance as smartly as they knew how, and attack the giant in their turn. They then made their way to the taller of the two peaks. There, they handed their horses over to their squires and began to clamber to the top, Arthur going on ahead. At that moment, the inhuman monster was standing by his fire. His face was smeared with the clotted blood of a number of pigs at which he had been gnawing. He had swallowed bits of them while he was roasting the rest over the live embers on the spits to which he had fixed them. The moment he saw the newcomers, nothing then being farther from his thoughts, he rushed to snatch up his club, which two young men would have found difficulty in lifting off the ground. The king drew his sword from its scabbard, held his shield out in front of him, and rushed forward at full speed to prevent the giant from seizing his club. The giant was quite aware of the advantage Arthur was hoping to gain. He took up his club and dealt the king such a mighty blow on his shield that he filled the shore in either direction with the reverberation of the impact and deafened Arthur's ears completely. The king grew white hot in the fierceness of his rage. He struck the giant on the forehead with his sword and gave him such a blow that, although it was not mortal, all the same, the blood ran down his face and into his eyes and prevented him from seeing. The giant had warded off the blow with his club, and in this way he had protected his forehead from a mortal wound. Blinded as he was by the blood which was gushing out, he rushed forward all the more fiercely. Just as a boar hurls itself at the huntsman, despite the latter's boar spear, so the giant rushed against the king's sword. He seized Arthur round the middle and forced him to the ground on his knees. Arthur gathered his strength and quickly slipped out of the giant's clutches. Moving like lightning, he struck the giant repeatedly with his sword, first in this place, then in that, giving him no respite until he had dealt him a lethal blow by driving the whole length of the blade into his head just where his brain was protected by his skull. At this, the evil creature gave one great shriek and toppled to the ground with a mighty crash, like some oak torn from its roots by the fury of the winds. The king laughed with relief. He ordered Bedivere to saw off the giant's head and to hand it over to one of their squires so that it might be carried to the camp for all to go and stare at. Arthur said that he had not come into contact with anyone so strong since the time he killed the giant Retho on Mount Arvius, after the latter had challenged him to single combat. Retho had made himself a fur cloak from the beards of the kings whom he had slain. He sent a message to Arthur, telling him to rip his own beard off his face, and when it was torn off, to send it him. Since Arthur was more distinguished than any of the other kings, Retho promised in his honour to sew his beard higher up the cloak than the others. If Arthur would not do this, then Retho challenged him to a duel, saying that whoever proved the stronger should have the fur cloak as a trophy, and also the beard of the man he had beaten. Soon after the battle began, Arthur was victorious. He took the giant's beard and the trophy too. From that day on, as he had just said, he had met nobody stronger than Retho. When they had won their victory, the three men returned to their tents with the head just as dawn was succeeding to night. All their men crowded round them to gape at it and praise the man who had freed the country from such a voracious monster. Hoel, however, grieved over the fate of his niece. He ordered a chapel to be built above her grave on the mountain top where she had been buried. The peak took its name from the girl's burial place, and to this very day it is called Helena's tomb. As soon as all those whom Arthur was awaiting had finally assembled, he marched from there to Autun, where he expected that the emperor would be. However, by the time he reached the river Albi, he was informed that the emperor had pitched his camp not far away and was advancing with such an enormous army that it was being said that no one could possibly resist him. Arthur was not dismayed, for he had no intention whatsoever of abandoning the plans which he had made. Instead, he pitched his own camp on the riverbank in a spot from which he could easily move his camp forward or, if the need arose, withdraw under cover. Arthur sent two of his leaders, Bozo of Oxford and Geryn of Chartres, together with his own nephew Gawain, to Lucius Hyberius to tell him either to withdraw altogether from Gallic territory, or else to march out the next day to see which of them had more right to Gaul. The young men of Arthur's court were overjoyed at the prospect before them. They began to egg Gawain on to foment some incident in the emperor's camp to give them an opportunity of fighting with the Romans. They made their way into the presence of Lucius and duly ordered him either to withdraw from Gaul or to come out to fight the very next day. As Lucius was replying that he had not come there in order to withdraw, but rather that he might govern the country, his nephew, Gaius Quintilianus, who was present, was heard to mutter that the Britons were better at boasting and making threats than they were at proving their courage and prowess on the battlefield. Gawain was immediately incensed at this. He drew his sword from the scabbard which was hanging at his belt, rushed at Gaius, and cut off his head. He and his fellow envoys then retreated to their horses. The Romans pursued them, some on foot and some on horseback, hoping to avenge the loss of their fellow countrymen upon the messengers, who were making off at full speed. Geryn of Chartres suddenly turned around, just as one of the Romans was straining to hit him, couched his lance, pierced the enemy through his protective armour and the middle of his body, and hurled him to the ground with all his might. Bozo of Oxford, envious of the mighty deed done by the man from Chartres, wheeled his own horse around and stuck his spear into the throat of the first man he met, mortally wounding him and dashing him from the nag on which he was careering along. In the meantime, Marcellus Mutius was making every effort to avenge Quintilianus. He was already threatening Gawain from the rear and was on the point of laying hold of him when Gawain swung round and with the sword which he brandished clove him through the helm and head to his chest, bidding him, when he got to hell, to tell Quintilianus, whom Gawain had just cut down in the camp, that this was why the Britons were so good at boasting and making threats. Gawain drew his troops up in some order, and ordered them to wheel round in formation, each doing his utmost to unhorse one of the enemy. They agreed to what he proposed. They all turned back, and each of them killed his man. All the same, the Romans continued the pursuit, hitting out at the Britons with their swords and spears, but not succeeding in capturing or unhorsing any of them. Just as they were riding up to a certain wood, so the story goes, there suddenly emerged from the trees about 6,000 Britons, who had heard of the retreat of their leaders, and had concealed themselves there in order to bring them help. Out they came, sticking spurs into their horses and filling the air with their shouts. With their rounded shields hung in front of their chests, they attacked the Romans out of the blue, and immediately drove them back in flight. The Britons chased after the Romans as one man, hurling some of them from their horses with their spears, capturing others and killing quite a few. When this was made known to the senator Petreius, he hurried to the assistance of his comrades, accompanied by 10,000 men. He forced the Britons to withdraw to the wood from which they had emerged, but not before he had lost some of his own men in the process. As they fled, the Britons turned at bay in the narrow woodland paths and inflicted great slaughter on their pursuers. Meanwhile, Hyderus, the son of Neu, was hurrying forward to support them as they retreated in this way. The Britons then made a stand, showing their chests now to the same Romans to whom they had previously presented their backs, and doing their level best to deal mighty blows in the most manly way possible. The Romans, too, stood to their ground, in some sectors managing to kill the Britons, but elsewhere being killed by them. The Britons wanted a fight with all their heart and soul, but once they had begun it, they did not care much whether they won or lost. The Romans, on the other hand, who were given careful instructions as to when they should move forward and when retreat by Petreius Cocta, like the good captain he was, behaved with more circumspection, so that Petreius was able to inflict great damage on his opponents. As soon as Boso noticed this, he called aside from the others a number of the Britons whom he knew to be among the bravest, and delivered the following speech to them. "Seeing that we began this skirmish without informing Arthur, we must take great care, now that our men are fully engaged, that we do not have the worst of it. If that does happen, then we shall suffer a great loss of manpower, and at the same time have the king cursing us. You must all pluck up your courage and follow me through the ranks of the Romans, so that, if fortune favours us, we can either kill or capture Petreius." They all set spurs to their horses, and, keeping close together, forced their way through the wedge-shaped ranks of the enemy. They reached the spot where Petreius was giving orders to his men. Boso rushed headlong at him, seized him round the neck, and fell to the ground with him as he had planned. The Romans came running up to rescue Petreius from his assailants. At the same time, the Britons moved forward to give every help to Boso. There followed a tremendous slaughter between the two sides, with much din and confusion, as the Romans tried to free their leader, and the Britons strove to hold him captive. Men were wounded on both sides as they dealt deadly blows and received them. In this contest, it was made quite clear who was the better man with spear, sword, and javelin. In the end, the Britons advanced with closed ranks, withheld the onslaught of the Romans, and made their way with Petreius in their midst to the safety of their own lines. Without a moment's respite, they then made a counterattack upon the Romans, who were now for the most part weakened, dispirited, and ready to show their backs, for they had lost their commander. The Britons pressed on against them, striking at them from the rear. They unhorsed them with their blows, plundered them where they lay, and rode on over their looted bodies in pursuit of the others. A few they took prisoner, for they wanted some to hand over to the king. In the end, when they had done all the damage they could to the Romans, the Britons withdrew to their camp with their spoils and prisoners. They explained what had happened to them, and with the joy of victory in their hearts, handed Petreius Cocta and the rest of their captives over to Arthur. He congratulated them, and promised them honours, and yet more honours, in that they had behaved so gallantly, although he was not there to lead them. He decided to throw the captives into prison. He summoned to his presence the men who were to lead them off to Paris the following day, and hand them over to the town jailers for safekeeping, against the time when he should decide what else should be done with them. He ordered Duke Cador, Bedivere the cupbearer, and Borellus and Richerius, two of his leading men, with their personal bodyguards, to lead the party, until they reached a spot beyond which they need not really fear a rescue attempt by the Romans. It so happened that the Romans got wind of what the Britons had planned. At their emperor's command, they chose 15,000 of their troops, who, that very same night, were to hurry on ahead of the Britons along their projected line of march, and then to attack them, and do their utmost to free their fellow countrymen. The Romans put two senators, Valtius Catulus and Quintus Carucius, in charge of their troops, together with Evander, the king of Syria, and Sertorius, the king of Libya. That very night they set out with the force which I have described, intending to follow the line of march as instructed. They chose a place suitable for an ambush, and hid in a spot through which they thought their enemies would pass. After morning came, the Britons duly set out with their captives. They soon came near to the place in question, not realizing what a trap their cunning enemies had prepared for them. As the Britons moved forward in their march, the Romans suddenly broke cover. They attacked the Britons, who were expecting nothing of the sort, and broke their line. Although they were attacked unexpectedly and scattered, the Britons reformed their lines and resisted bravely. They stationed some of their troops in a circle round the prisoners. The remainder they drew up into companies, which then engaged the enemy. The Britons put Richerius and Bedivere in charge of the force which they set to guard the prisoners. Cador, Duke of Cornwall, and Borellus were given command of the others. The entire Roman detachment had rushed out in a disorderly fashion without troubling to draw their men up into companies. They attacked with all their might, aiming to slaughter the Britons, while the latter were still drawing up their own battle lines and making plans to defend themselves. The Britons suffered great losses, and would have endured the shame of losing the captives whom they were convoying, if good fortune had not quickly brought the reinforcements of which they were in such need. Guitard, the Duke of the Poitevins, came to hear of the ambush which I have described, and he marched in with 3,000 men. Now that they were able to rely upon this help, the Britons won in the end, and so managed to take revenge upon their imprudent ambushers for all the slaughter they had caused. However, they lost many of their troops in the first stage of the battle. Indeed, they lost Borellus, the famous leader of the Cenomani, who was pierced through the throat by his opponent's spear while he was fighting with Evander, the king of Syria, and so vomited forth his life with his blood. At the same time, they lost four noble princes: Harolgas of Perion, Maurice Cador of Cahors, Aliduke of Tintagel, and Hur, the son of Hyder. It would not have been easy to find braver men than these. However, the Britons did not lose their courage, nor did they despair. They made every effort to press forwards, doing their utmost to guard their prisoners, and at the same time to destroy their enemies. In the end, the Romans were unable to stand the attack which the Britons launched, and they quickly retreated from the battlefield and began to make for their own camp. The Britons pursued them relentlessly, killing them as they went and taking many captives. They allowed them no respite until they had killed Valtius Catulus and Evander, the king of Syria, and scattered the others completely. Once they were sure of victory, the Britons sent on to Paris the prisoners they were convoying. They themselves turned back to their king, with those whom they had just captured, promising him hope of a decisive victory, in that they who were so few had triumphed over this immense enemy which had been dispatched against them. Lucius Hiberius bore all these disasters ill. Harassed as he was by a variety of anxieties, he swayed first this way and then that, for he could not make up his mind whether to engage in a full-scale battle with Arthur or to withdraw inside Autumn and there await reinforcements from the Emperor Leo. In the end, he let his misgiving take the upper hand. The next night, he marched his troops into Langres on his way to the city of Autumn. This move was reported to Arthur. He made up his mind to outmarch Lucius along this route. That same night, he bypassed the city of Langres on his left hand and entered a valley called Soissy, through which Lucius would have to pass. Arthur decided to draw up his troops in battle formation. He ordered one legion, the command of which he entrusted to Earl Morvid, to stay constantly in reserve, so that, if need arose, he would know where he could withdraw, refit his companies, and plan new attacks on the enemy. He drew up the remainder of his troops in 7 divisions, to each of which he allocated 5,555 fully equipped men. One part of each of the divisions which he drew up consisted of cavalry, and the second part of foot soldiers. They were given the following standing orders. Whenever the infantry showed signs of advancing to the attack, the cavalry of that division, moving forward obliquely with closed ranks, should do its utmost to break the force of the enemy. According to the British custom, the infantry battalions were drawn up in a square with a right and left wing. Augustulus, the King of Albany, was put in charge of the right wing, and Cador, Duke of Cornwall, of the left wing of the 1st Division. 2 famous leaders, Gerin of Chartres and Bozo of Redachen, called Oxford in the Saxon language, were put in command of a 2nd division, with Ashkill, King of the Danes, and Loth, King of the Norwegians, in charge of a 3rd. Hwel, King of the Bretons, and Gawain, the king's nephew, commanded a 4th. In support of these, 4 other divisions were placed in the rear. Kay, the seneschal, was put in charge of 1, along with Bedivere the cupbearer. Holdin, the leader of the Rutini, and Guittard, Duke of the Poitavans, commanded the 2nd. Dugain of Leicester, Jonathel of Dorchester, and Kersalem of Caistor took charge of the 3rd, and Urbgenius of Bath of the 4th. Behind all these, the king chose a position for himself, and for a single legion, which he had appointed to remain under his orders. There, he set up the golden dragon, which he had as his personal standard. To this point, the wounded and exhausted could withdraw, in case of necessity, as if to a fortified camp. In the legion which he held back, under his own command, there were 6,666 men. When all his troops were placed in position, Arthur gave them the following order of the day. My countrymen, you who have made Britain mistress of 30 kingdoms, I commend you for your courage, which, far from lessening, seems to me to increase in strength every day, despite the fact that you have waged no war for 5 long years, during which time you have devoted yourselves to the enjoyment of a life of ease rather than to the practice of war. Nevertheless, you do not seem to have degenerated in the least from your inborn valour. On the contrary, you have retained your courage to the full, for you have just put the Romans to flight at a moment when, encouraged by the pride which came so naturally to them, they were doing their utmost to deprive you of your freedom. Moving forward, with the advantage of numbers on their side, it was they who attacked you, but they were not strong enough to resist your advance, and they had to withdraw in shame to that city over there. In a short time, they will march out again and come through this valley on their way to Autumn. You will be able to attack them when they least expect it, and slaughter them like so many sheep. No doubt they imagined, when they planned, to make your country pay them tribute, and to enslave you yourselves, that they would discover in you the cowardice of the eastern peoples. Perhaps they have not heard of the wars you waged against the Danes and Norwegians and the leaders of the Gauls when you delivered these peoples from their shameful allegiance to the Romans and forced them to submit to my own overlordship. We, who had the strength to win a mightier battle, will, without any doubt at all, be successful in this more trifling affair, if only we make up our minds with the same determination to crush these feeble creatures. What rewards you will win, if only you obey my will and my orders as loyal soldiers ought to do. Once we have beaten the Romans in the field, we can immediately set off for Rome itself. As soon as we march upon Rome, we shall capture it. When we have captured it, you shall occupy it, and yours shall be its gold, silver, palaces, towers, castles, cities, and all the other riches of the vanquished. As Arthur spoke, they all joined in one great shout of approval, for, as long as he was still alive, they were ready to die rather than leave the battlefield.